The world into which Jesus and the apostles were born was heavily influenced by something known as Hellenism. And to fully understand Jesus and what he said and the New Testament writers, we have to be aware of this Hellenistic mindset. Hellenism is the national character and culture of ancient Greece, which dominated the Eastern Mediterranean and Middle Eastern world from about 300 years before to about 300 years after the time of Jesus. And a core value of Hellenism was that the citizens of the Greco-Roman world, including the region of Judea, were expected to live virtuous lives. Virtue means the excellent qualities of men or mankind. And forming and adhering to lists of virtues was considered to be an essential way of separating in the world order from chaos. Long before the Greeks, the ancient Egyptians had their lists of values that they called muat, and they included things like truth, balance, order, morality, and justice. The ancient Japanese Bushido code is characterized by 10 virtues, including goodness, courage, and benevolence. Buddhism's Brahmavihara comprised the 4 virtues of loving kindness, compassion, empathy, and something which is best translated as stability of mind. The 4 classical cardinal virtues of Greece were temperance, prudence, courage, and justice. And to those 4, the Catechism of the Catholic Church added the 3 theological values or virtues of faith, hope, and charity or love. So defining and listing what a virtuous life looked like was common practice during the time that the Apostle Paul wrote. And he uses this methodology to great effect when faced with the question of how could a Christian know how to live in a way that pleased God without the parameters and support of the law of Moses. I want you to recognize and remind ourselves of how central the law of Moses, the Torah, was for a Jew. It informed everything about how to live and how not to live. If you take that away, and you, even though you're now talking to Gentiles, former pagans who never had the law, they still need something, they want something, so that they can judge themselves, evaluate their lives, and know that they're pleasing to God. As I mentioned, for the most part, Paul's audience in Galatia was not interested in Judaism or the laws of Moses, but they expected Paul to give them a Hellenistic style list of virtues so that they could know how to live their life so that they could receive what Paul was offering them through Christ, that is, blessings in this life and everlasting life after death. And a list of virtues and a corresponding list of vices allowed Paul to guide his followers through this new territory, this brand new territory of what he referred to as life in the Spirit. One of his greatest expressed disappointments was the tendency of believers to live as if their life had not changed. Sometimes people concluded that if there was no law, then you could do whatever you wanted. And Paul's point was that you can't just do what you want to do. You have to be transformed in this new life in the Spirit. But without a law to tell you how to live, some people didn't know what that meant. For Paul, living in the Spirit should cause a war within oneself. The spirit ought, he said, to be in conflict with the flesh. And Christians should always sense that struggle and should always make great efforts to allow the spirit to win that war over the flesh. His first letter to the church in Corinth is a rebuke against what we might loosely term worldliness. He famously criticizes them for showing preferential treatment, for example, for those who were wealthy among them in the congregation. He challenges their greed during the Lord's Supper, and he is incensed at their toleration of blatant immorality. The Spirit was there, he said, but for some of them it seemed like it just wasn't functioning. So Paul outlined what a Christian life should look like and what behaviors indicated that the Spirit was being stifled and suppressed. So his target is not behavior. His target is, are you living by the flesh or by the Spirit? And if your life is more fleshly than it should be, then it's not more rules you need, it's getting back to letting the Spirit control your life. So Paul expressed his views in Galatians 5, the virtues as the fruits of the Spirit, and then he listed the contrary works of the flesh. And I categorized them into the four following categories: spiritual perversion, unrestrained emotions, lack of moral self-control, and community disharmony. And as I mentioned before, he presents these merely as illustrations of the kinds of behaviors that are broken and dysfunctional, and most importantly, spiritless. Last time we talked about the first two of those works, so today I'll address the second two. So the next work of the flesh that we'll look at is lack of moral self-control. And this encompasses many specific behaviors. So Paul doesn't get too detailed. He stays with broad categories. And the first one we're going to look at is sexual immorality. The Greek word is porneia, which loosely refers to sexual intercourse outside of a loving, monogamous relationship, including rape, prostitution, and allowing oneself to be used for the purpose of sacred sexual rites, such as religious fertility rites, or something which was quite common called sacred or divine marriages. Since the time of Augustine in the 4th century, sexuality is an area of practice and behavior that the church has distorted and obsessed over probably more than anything else. So let's just be clear what Paul is saying and what he's not saying. Sexual relationships are not sinful. Enjoyment and pleasure are not sinful. Committed, loving relationships are good. These things should sound obvious, but they're not obvious. Greedy, self-absorbed, unloving, domineering, abusive sexual relationships are porneia. These are defined as works of the flesh. Every work of the flesh that Paul identifies, every work of the flesh is not so much about the behavior, but it is about the lack of love for others. If something is loving, it is a fruit of the Spirit. If something is not loving, it is a work of the flesh. This is all Paul is saying here. Remember, in the same chapter, Galatians 5, Paul had earlier stated, for the entire law, every last bit of it, the letter of the law and the spirit of the law, the entire law is fulfilled in keeping one command: love your neighbor as yourself. The next virtue is, or lack of virtue, is uncleanness. And the word here is akatharsia, and it means physical or moral impurity. Paul's really trying to get to the heart of his followers, not the letter of behaviors. Akatharsia is a matter of pure thoughts leading to pure actions. You can tell people to stop doing actions. Commandments are good at that. Laws and rules are good at saying, don't do this. But it doesn't stop you from wanting to do it. On one occasion in Paul's second letter to the Corinthians, he encouraged the Christians there to take captive every thought to make it obedient to Christ. And I think that's what akatharsia is talking about. Taking captive even your thoughts. So the concept of avoiding akatharsia is about refusing to be motivated and driven by the baser instincts, lust, greed, jealousy, vengeance, and the like. And it's about not being controlled by harmful and selfish emotions that have no care for other people. The next category of lack of virtue is what he calls drunkenness and carousing. He has a few different names for it. These behaviors simply demonstrate both a lack of self-control and a failure to acknowledge the seriousness of life. Paul isn't advocating that we become jaded by life and depressed or anxious about the future. But in light of Paul's belief in the soon coming return of Jesus, he calls on his followers to live soberly. So it's about a sober life. It's about not being flippant as you go through life, but recognizing the importance of the spiritual world and its impact on this life. The fourth and final category of works of the flesh is what I've called community disharmony. Now, obviously, Paul is referencing the church community in particular, communities that he personally built up and were being interfered with by other apostles and church leaders representing a more Jewish version of Christianity. I want to repeat that because we sometimes think, in times past, I've thought that it was Jews who were coming into his churches and telling them that they were wrong, that they needed to be circumcised, that they needed to stop eating pork or meat offered to idols. It wasn't Jews. It was Jewish Christians, or Christians with a Jewish background or leaning. But the underlying attitude that disrupts community harmony applies to any setting in community. The churches that Paul planted in Galatia, in Ephesus, Philadelphia, Colossae, Hierapolis, and others, as he states, were in turmoil. And they were divided over the one thing we should never fight over, and the one thing we fight over mostly, doctrine. To put it bluntly, Paul was in the middle of a power struggle with Jewish Christians, powerful Jewish Christians. Both sides claim greater spiritual authority. Both sides claimed a more direct revelation of Christ. The Jewish Christians said, "We knew Jesus." And Paul says, "I didn't need to know Jesus. He spoke to me personally in a way he's never spoken to any of you." Both sides called the others false apostles, apostates, and devil workers. So unity and adherence to his gospel was of utmost importance to Paul. Without it, everything he had worked for, everything he had sacrificed for, and even risked his life for, would be for nothing if the other side won. His opponents, felt Paul, had to be stopped, had to be silenced, and his opponents felt no less strongly about silencing him. So it's no surprise that Paul's final category of works of the flesh relates to the behavior of his enemies. as well as the natural tendency for some in any group to take a strong stance against those with whom we disagree, instead of simply allowing for disagreements. I hope that we have learned from our own experience that unity comes from a spirit of peace, never from enforced agreement and slavish adherence to dictated beliefs. I hope we have learned that we can allow for differences of opinion to coexist harmoniously. So the first virtue that Paul identifies in this category is the term dissensions. In the Greek, the word is deikostaseo. And when faced with authority telling us what to do, we always have two choices. We have the choice to consent, to agree, whether willingly or unwillingly, by force or by guilt. We may consent to follow that authority, or we have the choice to refuse that authority and to be a dissenter. Universal consent, everyone in agreement, really is what Paul needed and demanded in order for his form of Christianity to win over the Jewish form of Christianity, which he referred to as being led by dogs and mutilators of the flesh in Philippians 3. He said in that same chapter that he, Paul, needed to, quote, safeguard his followers from those other Christians, that other opposing form of Christianity. He saw himself as a protector of his people, whom he felt a very fatherly love towards. The next category of behavior is factions. Factions in the Greek is hereses, from which we get the word heresies. And as I've mentioned previously, the word heresy means to choose. And not a lot of people know that. We have such an assumption about a word like heresy. It's always stated in a bad context. It's always considered to be a thing that the church should run from. But heresy means to choose. It's the act of taking or deciding for yourself what to think. If you take an idea or a set of beliefs to be your own, rather than joining what has been presented to you by someone else, you have created a faction of one. You are a heretic. So if you talk to someone else and they say, you know what, I actually agree with your point of view, you now have a faction of two. And it is assumed that this is a bad thing. And it may well be, but not necessarily. We can clearly see why Paul would be very hostile to any sort of faction or dissension. He needed people to agree en masse with his point of view, with his gospel. Otherwise, once again, his work and his passion would have been for nothing. And of course, from an organizational standpoint, it is always much easier when you have a drawer full of yellow pencils, where everyone agrees to everything all the time. But when did that actually ever happen? Is that an ideal state to be in? Paul faced two severe challenges to that way of thinking as it related to the church. That is, wanting everyone to agree on everything all the time. Two major things challenge that. The first thing is, Paul was the heretic. Paul was the heretic. Don't think of heretic in a negative sense here. It was Paul who felt led by Christ to move away from the direction and teachings of the original Jerusalem church. He was convinced that Christ himself had revealed this truth that he preached, but it was clearly at odds with what James and Peter and John were teaching, what they were convinced Jesus had taught them. Secondly, if Paul alone had the truth and his followers were merely ordered to follow and to refrain from any independent thought, then what was the role of the Holy Spirit? If Jesus said the Holy Spirit was being sent to teach, to judge, to convict, to guide, to support, to lead, then you don't need that in any other person than the one person in charge, Paul. But that's not how the Spirit was said to work. We face exactly the same dilemma today in the church. Must a Christian at all times suppress and deny any leading of the Holy Spirit? Does God ever speak to you, or only exclusively to a select few at the top of a hierarchical pyramid? Is it even spiritually healthy to leave the direction of your life and salvation in the hands of a human intermediary? The church has done such an excellent job of controlling people for 2,000 years that we just take it for granted that we must obey, that we must agree, that we must cooperate, and we must submit. Well, we're told, if we don't obey, cooperate, submit, and agree, then there's just going to be anarchy. There's just going to be division. But division is in the mind, and the division occurs regardless of whether or not we state that we agree and obey and submit. But anarchy and rebellion are not the only alternatives. In life, there is never just two choices. There's never just this or that, black or white. There are always a range of ways to approach things. And I believe that mutual respect, submitting willingly by choice to one another, mutual submission, listening to the voice of God in each of us, is a better way forward. And the final characteristic in the works of the flesh that Paul gives is discord. Discord is the Greek word eris, and it means to be in a state of contention, wrangling, or variance. Notice that carefully. It's being in a state of contention, of wrangling, and variance. Discord does not mean disagreement. Discord is what you may do with your disagreement. It's what you follow it up with. Once you feel you have a different point of view, how do you handle that? If you are continually in a state of being at variance, of being confrontational, of being contentious, argumentative, fighting, that's discord. But disagreement is not discord. You can actually be in a state of discord and you actually agree with the person, but you argue anyway because you just want to be disagreeable. Do you know anyone like that? I'm not going to look at anyone right now. I don't know anyone like that. Let me just state that to deny to have an environment, an institution, a home, a business, anywhere where you deny the right of people to disagree, we have a name for that. It's called dictatorship. And don't say that God is the dictator because we're just following what he says. If that were the case, if it were that clear what he wanted, all Christians would agree on everything. To deny disagreement is dictatorship. And for most of its history, Christianity has operated as a totalitarian entity. And as such, has denied any serious avenue for expressing disagreement. So you have two choices. Keep it to yourself and don't tell anyone about it. Or you simply stop thinking for yourself. You believe that God would never speak to you. The Holy Spirit would never lead you in any other direction than in one direction. But even there, then, you have the choice of which of the denominational directions do you submit to and agree to wholeheartedly. Again, we can see why this was so important to Paul, and important to the point of excess. He was in a fight to defend his point of view, to defend all of his life's work after conversion, and he was losing it. It's really about a power struggle rather than simply a difference of opinion. Being contentious is an act of hostility. It refers to a state of constant opposition. For the sake of expressing one's refusal to submit to authority. It's about not letting anyone ever tell you what to think. It's about not being open to hear other people. It's about not being in a position where you can be led. No one is right all the time. Everyone should always be open to the possibility that we could reevaluate something and maybe learn a bit more truth out of this. What I'm saying is that institutions, church institutions, can create an environment where discord is more likely by labeling all disagreement as rebellion. Or an institution can decrease disagreement, or discord rather, by creating an environment where different points of view are encouraged. But why does the church do this? Why has it not welcomed diverse viewpoints and serious input from any and all members of the body? Because, unfortunately, in the process of listening and maybe learning from others, people feel they lose power. If we allow the masses to have input, you're going to get a lot of different points of view. And if you don't have a single authority to say, this is what you will think, this is what you will believe, then the power is spread amongst everyone. And we call that democracy. And democracy has not been welcomed, for the most part, in the church. But again, it's not a matter of anarchy. It's not a matter of everyone doing whatever feels right and good to them. It's about coming together and willingly submitting to one another and to wanting to learn from one another, and especially from those who have specific gifts of wisdom and teaching and knowledge, those who have more experience through age and life circumstances. The church loses power when individual members are permitted to make their own decisions regarding important things like abortions, using doctors or not using doctors, whether to tithe or not to tithe, whether to come to a church service or not go to a church service. Many people would look at those issues and come to the same decision. But we ought to be looking to the Spirit for guidance, for teaching, for direction. And in a spirit of harmony and peace, we will not be at war with one another. So Paul was an apostle under siege, both from the Roman and Jewish Christian authorities. But one thing that Paul was sure of, there was no longer any need in the Christian church for any influence of Judaism. No need for any Jewish customs or practices or laws. And so, with an outline of the works of the flesh identified, Paul moved next to discuss what the fruits of a life in the Spirit would look like. And we'll begin with that next time.